Are you insane?
They are insane.
You're in the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate.
But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
How you doing, Mike?
That man is bereft of passion and imagination.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
Let the lesson begin.
You're carving us up like a roast.
For the Horatio, gentlemen.
The Horatio.
When I was very young, I had a pet turtle. I don't remember its name. Those little, little tiny turtles. And I think my sister dropped it and killed it. And we had to bury it in a... We didn't have to, but we buried it in a Band-Aid box right outside our apartment complex. Then we had hamsters, and one of them got loose, and one of them actually crawled in through, like... It somehow got on the walls. I don't know how it did. It got on the walls. And I was so upset because we could hear it scratching. And so I took an axe when I was a kid. An axe, or maybe it was a hammer. I hammered a hole trying to find it. We couldn't find it. My mom later told me that it died. And they think that it died on one of the hot water pipes. And so you could smell it for weeks. I don't remember that part. When I was a little bit older, I was very, very excited to show my friend Dan Shin my new Darth Vader costume. This is when Darth Vader had just... come out just did 77. And I was so excited. And I walked out as they're playing with my sister's gerbil on the ground. And I didn't see it. And I stepped on it as Darth Vader. The loss of a pet is painful. Especially when you're to blame for it. Especially when you're sitting there as Darth Vader staring at this poor creature, which is like scurrying around dying. Ugh, the worst. What if you had to go back to do it in order to save the future? I'm Mike McCaffrey. I just want to talk about Star Trek. And we have been bereft in talking about the animated series until now. I'm trying to sweep through and talk about some of the more important episodes, at least to me. And this is the one. This is the one, if you watch the animated series, this is the one that you want to watch. Yesteryear. Second episode of this series. And so I'm just going to dive into it. I'm going to deep dive into it. The Fools Aren't Here. We were going to do a podcast this past week, but there was an unfortunate run-in with a lot of red wine. We will recap that at some point in time, because that is the stuff of Is There No Truth Beauty, or what is that? Name of the Rose? No, what is that? The one where Scotty gets really drunk to get those Andorian guys drunk. It is green. It's green. What is that? It's green. Oh, it was rough. It was so rough. This isn't about that. Although, sometimes you wish you could go back, right? You can go back and change the past. First of all, I wish these damn planes would stop going overhead. You wish you could go back. You wish you had a guardian of forever to take you back and to fix the things which you have made mistakes of. And certainly... this Wednesday, colossal mistake, myself and the doctor and Jason to a smaller degree and Matt Stomping Thompson to a lesser degree also did. But certainly me, it cost me 36 hours of my life trying to recover from that. And I wish I could have gone to the Guardian forever, which is Guardian, take me back. Take me back to like Wednesday at like 4 o'clock and said, Mike, get some food in you. Ease off on the red wine a little bit. And for God's sakes... after several bottles of red wine, don't pull out that bottle of chocolate red wine and try to drink it, because that will kill. That knocked us all out. That did us in. That's your big takeaway from this podcast. Don't drink chocolate wine. It is such a disaster. Ugh. But sometimes we have to go back. Sometimes we have to go back to change stuff. And that's what this episode is, Yesteryear. Yesteryear also refers to me as to a simpler time. A simpler time when I was growing up was Saturday morning cartoons. If you're of a certain age, you remember Saturday morning cartoons with fondness. A little bit of trepidation, because you never know what you're going to get every year. It was a little bit of a grab bag. But Saturday morning cartoons, now we bathe in content. Now there is television everywhere at your beck and call that you can just dial up. You can dial it up and you can watch whatever you want to watch. But back in the day, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s, but you know, if you didn't get Nickelodeon, Saturday mornings were sacred time for kids. Because they figured out in the 60s, if you run Bugs Bunny cartoons, the old Bugs Bunny shorts that ran in the movies in the 40s and 50s, Saturday mornings, you actually got kind of okay ratings. And so they did that. And then they started counter-programming that, other networks, and then they started coming up with their own animation blocks, basically. So every Saturday morning, it was your reward for watching, like, bad adult television, television you didn't understand as a kid. It was your reward for getting through a whole week of school. It was your reward for life. Saturday morning, you got up, you watched cartoons. There's actually an FM podcast about Saturday morning Star Trek, and screw them. Screw. You know what? Those jackasses FM, they may be winning, but they're not winning in my heart. All right, so back to me, back to Saturday morning cartoons. One of the cartoons that I watched as a young kid was Star Trek the Animated Series, and that one was so baffling. Now, at the time, Star Trek was running in reruns, and you know, as a young kid, you have no idea what the difference is, but all of a sudden, they're running the show Star Trek the Animated Series, and I can't remember if they're rerunning that as well, because it only lasted like a season and a half, technically. I mean, it was 2 seasons, really, but it was like they kind of broke up one season into two. And they showed this show, and as I've said before, the Animated Series, and really, to everyone in Star Trek, we all concede that, yes, Star Trek the Animated Series is a series about Star Trek, but we are uncomfortable labeling it as canon. Now, I think I've told you before that actually Gene Roddenberry's assistant, one time when CBS called and said, hey, is Star Trek the Animated Series canon? And like without like Roddenberry's, you know, blessing, he said, no, not really. And so that's where it became non-canon. Even though Gene Roddenberry really wanted it to be canon, to him, he thought, this is the extension of my science fiction storytelling. I can tell stories even better, with better effects. Well, he'd be wrong about that. But far-reaching, more grand, more epic in scale by having these animated stories play out with the cast. This gives me a larger palette to tell more serious, more interesting stories. And for the most part, he was wrong. For the most part, Filmation, Lou Schreiber and Hal Sutherland, I believe. I'm just pulling those out of my head. All I can remember is their little circling logo at the end of every episode, or actually the beginning of every opening credits, which was better animated than anything in the entire episode itself. I don't want to besmirch these guys. Maybe I do. And certainly since I had a chance to be part of the Star Trek animation crew recently, I'll tell you about that sometime. But I will say this. Hanna-Barbera started to lower the bar in the 60s and 70s for animation, basically by, you know, cutting down from 24 frames per second to like maybe 12 frames per second, and then maybe even going down to, who knows, just like animating the mouths. Someone pulled up a very interesting point about Hanna-Barbera characters, that they all wear ties or all have collars. That's because they all had to do is animate the heads. Interesting, right? Economical. And, you know, the Flintstones, funny enough, right? I mean, good enough, funny enough. Jetson's pretty good. But then the quality started going down, and even though Hanna-Barbera had a standard, you get other animation companies which started to even chip away at that. And to me, Filmation was one of them. Now, Filmation also did shows like, I believe they did He-Man and Ghostbusters, and just, there's something nightmarish about it to me. There's something just very disturbing about their animation. And probably the pinnacle of that is Star Trek the Animated Series, at least to me. Star Trek the Animated Series feels like a fever dream to me. I watch it, and it is slow, it is ponderous. The actors all seem as though they're drugged. As I've told you before, I watch a lot of these episodes at like 33% faster speed on YouTube. I'm able to, like, even on Netflix, I'm able to speed it up just because it's so slow. It's just, it's not good. So as we look back at this series, do we anoint this as being something which is canon? Generally, no. Because, I mean, first of all, there's no Eriks, there's no whatever her name was, the purring Catwoman, the Catians, the Catians. There's no Chekhov, although in this episode there's kind of like a fake Chekhov. It's just kind of a mess. And so it's easy to discount these slow, dragging on episodes, except for this one, except for Yesteryear. And I even remember as a kid watching it, and it moved me. And it was maybe still a little bit slow, but it was also sad, a little terrifying, but also something that you never forget. Okay, so let's get into it a little bit, all right? So let's talk a little bit about this. So this was the second episode to come out of the union of Filmation and Gene Roddenberry. So obviously they're coming out of the gate with a little more zest, and then it seems like afterwards, you know, they kind of ran out of ideas or went for far-reaching stuff. But this is one written by DC Fontana, as in Dorothy Fontana. And already let's concede the fact that we're in a different time. You know, I'm going to talk about Gene Roddenberry at some point in time, his good and his bad. There's a lot of Me Too in Gene Roddenberry. There is. There's stuff there which is just going to be like, whoo, man, we're watching a show created by someone who is not super cool. But to his credit, he loved women, and he also was not afraid of elevating women into certain positions, such as the number one character, Majel Barrett, even though he was sleeping with her. Okay, so we're okay with that. But he was willing to give that a female lead role in that. Didn't work out. And also willing to give Dorothy Fontana a shot at writing episodes, which she did. Journey to Babel, and I can't remember the other one she wrote. She wrote a couple for the original series. And she was given, right out of the box, she was given an episode to write here. And so she wanted to go back to Vulcan. She had an affinity for Vulcans, affinity for the Vulcan culture, and so she did. And she also cleverly pulled in the Guardian of Forever. Now, the Guardian of Forever, as I talked before, is this insane, amazing thing which can fix so many ills or destroy so many things. I don't know why the Guardian of Forever, like the Genesis Project, caused a big ripple of you know, terror among the Klingons and a big hubbub in the Federation because it was this weapon of destruction. What about the Guardian of Forever? What if you could go through a portal and change any part of history, intentionally or unintentionally? What would you do with that? I mean, you would blow it up, right? You have to. It is the ultimate weapon. It is the doomsday machine times a billion because someone can go in and say, take me back to the birth of humanity, and I'm just going to stop that. And there it is. Now, as we've seen in Year of Hell, which my son just watched and loved, Voyager episode, it's easy to never be able to get it to exactly what you want. But that huge, huge thing is sitting, that huge weapon is sitting there on that planet full of Roman columns everywhere. And we never go back to it. We never go back to it in any of the other series at all, except for the animated series. So there's one thing we got. Hey, in Star Trek IV, they could have gone back to the Guardian of Forever and changed stuff, right? They could have gone back in First Contact. Like, oh, shit, well, let's go back to the Guardian of Forever and let's go back and change that. It's the reset button. It's the TiVo back button. But no one ever uses it, except in the animated series. Now, we start out, and I may be scrubbing through a little bit and watching bits of it, in just the most bizarre scene. So they start with a shot of the Guardian of Forever, and then there's McCoy, this woman in like kind of a magenta outfit. She sort of looks like Majel Barrett. I'm sure they use that as a template. And then this weird winged bird creature with no pants on. All right. I just want to go. We could do a whole episode about this, that there's, we start out like that. There's this crazy creature. And what the hell is this creature's name? Alec Ohm, which is, I don't even know what the hell kind of species he is. Probably something like a Birdian or something. An Aurelian. You know, he's an Aurelian. And we're never going to see that guy again because he's just this crazy bird creature, yellow. He looks like Big Bird, but like terrifying, holding a tricorder at the Guardian Forever. And no one's at all like, you know, freaked out about this. But then Kirk and Spock and historian Erickson, I don't know why, you know, he comes through. Why not Sulu? Why not somebody else? Actually, Sulu wasn't in this one. And they come through. Kirk comes through. Erickson comes through. And then Spock comes through, and everyone's like, who's that? And in fact, if you listen to Leonard DeForest Kelly, he has the most low energy read. Who's that, Jim? Like, as this other person comes to the Guardian of the Forever, as they're watching, like, the birth of the Orion Empire. And that's another thing, too. Let me just stop and say, in addition to Filmation having a difficult time animating stuff and reusing footage all the time and cell animation all the time, the voice acting was terrible. There was never a time I felt as though any of the actors were seriously engaged in this. I don't know if they were in like some sort of closet when they were doing their reads, if there was something else going on in the other room and they had to be quiet, but no one ever raises their voice above like talking, you know, like room tone, basically. And this is one of those instances where McCoy's like, who's that, Jim? It's so low key. It's so, you know, meandering. And all of their reads are, even though in this one, I guess they were all together to do the reads. A lot of times Shatner went away to do a lot of these reads. He was like touring. But they're so like, just like lazy, I guess. There's no stakes to any of that. But anyway, so they come through, Spock comes through, and no one knows who Spock is except for Kirk. And I guess Erickson. Maybe Erickson might remember that. So, I mean, that's his little treat. Maybe he doesn't. I don't remember if he remembers that. So they beam up, and still no one knows who he is. And Kirk's like, hey, man, you better treat my first officer with respect. And then this, what is his name? Thalen comes in. This Andorian first officer comes in. Thalen. I love Thalen. Thalen is like the MVP of this episode. So no one knows what the hell's going on, but then they start to piece it together that something that happened somehow when they went through the Guardian Forever, and they should know this. They should know. Like they said, oh, we didn't touch anything when we went through the Guardian Forever. It should be all fine. No, you guys. Don't go through it. Just scan it. Scan the time and don't go through it. Oh, this is really cool. You know, if you go see a baseball game, just watch it. Don't go on the field. Just watch it. That's fine. You don't need to do anything. Just. But they do. And they start to piece together the fact that Spock was never part of the Federation. In fact, he died. He died while he was going through the... And I'm sorry, you guys. I just got to come up with those crazy names here. It's this Vulcan ritual... I don't know. The Kazwan, which seems kind of cool. You go out in the desert for like, you know, like 2 weeks without any food or water and you survive. Sounds pretty cool. But he died out there. And so he as a result, Sarek and Amanda split up. Kind of a cool kind of thing, right? And so they deduce that while Spock was watching the Orion doing this stuff and they were actually scanning Vulcan history. This is where it gets a little confusing. Spock wasn't able to go back to that Vulcan history and affect his younger self. Now we're getting all this paradox nonsense. But that's fine. We'll put a pin in that. Because Spock does remember. He's like, oh, you know what? I do remember a cousin showing up. And I think Kirk says, what was his name? He's like, I don't remember his name, but his name was Selleck. Which is kind of a strange... It's like, did anyone check that script? But Selleck, comma Tom, visited young Spock. And so they surmise that Spock has to go back. He has to go back and save himself from dying. This is the Kirk's reading glasses paradox, isn't it? Where Kirk sells the reading glasses in Star Trek IV so that McCoy will buy them and give them back to him in Star Trek II, and these glasses just kind of don't exist. Same thing like the name Selleck. Where did the name Selleck come from? He just kind of created it. It's one of these paradoxes that exist, but we're going to move past that. So they decide, okay, Spock, you got to go back. You got to go back and help yourself from dying. Sounds good. And one of my favorite parts of all of this is where Thalen, the Andorian commander, is basically okay with this. Where he's like, yeah, go back and erase me. Go back and make me unexist or make me not be like the first officer of the Federation flagship. That's cool. But it is cool. Because it's this logical discussion between this Andorian and this Vulcan, and they're both like, Thalen's like, you know what? I don't necessarily approve of this on me, but like I'm big on family, and if this saves your mother and your father from grieving about you and keeps them together, I'm all in. He gives them the Vulcan sign. It's badass. Thalen, they should have brought that guy back, even though he's not blue in this. He's gray. I think they missed the coloring of him. It's kind of weird. Spock goes back, and then we get into the past. He goes to the capital, Shikar, like Shere Khan, Shikar. And this is one of the things at least you get with animations. You get to kind of see the city a little bit. But again, because the animation is so shoddy, it's like this weird painting. And then they just kind of do like a manual push in on it. We see Spock being bullied by these like shirtless boys who wear like strange seatbelt straps around their like sashes around them, who push him down because he is illogical and human, and like, you guys are bullies. I mean, you're showing emotion right now, anyways. And that's when Spock shows up, and then he kind of invites. He's like, "Oh, I'm your cousin. Yeah, take me home." So he goes home and he meets his dad. And this is the great thing, too, is we get Mark Leonard. So if you're just watching this, if you're watching this like back in like 72 or 74 when it first came out, you're like, holy shit, this is, maybe the show, there is something to this. Because look, we got Mark Leonard as a guest star. This is so great. That'd be like one of the last guest stars they ever had. Did I forget about talking about that weird Chekhov guy? They couldn't afford Chekhov, speaking of which. They were able to afford Sulu and Uhura, Nichelle Nichols and George Takei, but they couldn't for some reason afford Chekhov. So in the animation, there's this weird guy who pops up on the screen. I'll post it. By the way, check out our Facebook page. I just want to talk about Star Trek, if this is your first time. And I'll post this picture of this weird, sad guy who probably was supposed to be Chekhov, but they just could never get the money to afford Chekhov. But he looks like he's had a tough life. His eyebrows are constantly arched in a sadness look. He's very sad. Spock goes back. He goes back, he meets his younger self, who gets neck pinched. He doesn't know how to do all this stuff because he's half human. And Sarek is like, Spock, you're gonna have to make a decision right now. And also with Amanda. Amanda's there, not unfortunately, but voiced by Mary Jo Barrett. But it would have been nice to have Jane Wyatt, right? I mean, that would have been so luxurious to have these voice actors. Because Mark Leonard does a good job. Mark Leonard, he kind of leaves it all on the table there. I mean, like, it's still that stoic kind of low-key stuff, but he's Sarek. If you watch this show, watch it for Sarek. Watch it for the Spock. Watch it for the Vulcan mythology that is built in this, which was later on used. We'll talk about that in a minute, too. So basically, Sarek says, hey, man, you're going to go out on this trip, this Shikar, and you're going to have to figure out if you're going to follow the human path or the Vulcan path. This is huge, right? I mean, this is the moment. This is the moment that we want to see in Spock's evolution that we didn't know existed, that he had to make that choice right there. That his dad was saying, dude, you got to pick one. Now, ultimately, he did pick the Vulcan, but then he went to Starfleet. So it's kind of a mix and match on that as well. And his mom's right there as well. So this is all, this is a moment hanging in the balance. And of course, then cousin Selleck shows up and Sarek, like infinitely wise, is like, oh, I don't quite remember you. He's like, oh, I'm just passing through town. Well, sure, you can stay here. Is there no internet? Is there no like anyone you can call and say, do I have a cousin named Selleck who looks a lot like my son would in like 35 to 40 years? All cool. It's all fine. Now one of the other parts that's coming into this is that young Spock has his Salat, Ichia, depending on how you want to pronounce it. The kid pronounces Ichia. I can't remember. He mispronounces it, actually. It's supposed to be Ichia. Or maybe I've got it wrong. It doesn't matter. He mispronounced it. We'll talk about it in a minute. This big teddy bear creature, which was, of course, invoked in Journey to Babel by his mom. Oh, he had a Salat, you know, sort of like a big teddy bear. And, well, it's a teddy bear with 6-inch long fangs, Dr. McCoy. So we have this animal here. And Spock makes this decision that he's going to... It's weird. It's a weird kind of bit where he's like, before I go off on this test, I'm going to go out in the desert and figure out if I can survive, which is like, well, okay. So he goes out, Ichia follows him, and Spock follows him eventually because he realizes that he's left. He remembered. He was like, oh my God, that's what happened. I should also point out, I know this is going a little bit mixed right now, is that Spock, whenever he does a mission log, he does subjective time. He does a star date, comma, subjective time, which is a nice little touch. Like kids, like a six-year-old's not going to know what the hell that means. Like I barely even understand what that means. But they put that in there. So young Spock goes out in the desert, and then they're attacked by Limata, which looks like a weird cat dog and sounds just like Godzilla. They basically took the sound cue from Godzilla and used that. Ichaya gets in the way, saves young Spock basically from being attacked, and then old Spock jumps on his back, on the Limata's back, and gives him the Vulcan nerve pitch. Boom, that creature's down. But the bad news is that Ichaya has been bitten. And so they have to get a healer. They have to get a healer to go fix him. So young Spock decides to take it upon himself to run to get the healer. Again, there's no communication here. Why don't they have communicators? Like, why doesn't Spock have a communicator? Because he knows what's coming up, right? Maybe he doesn't. Actually, he doesn't at this point in time. This is the interesting part, too. Young Spock runs back and gets the healer, and they bring him back. And the healer says, it's been too long. You took too long to run. There was this weird, terrifying, vined creature which wants to suck out all of your moisture. Terrified me as a kid. Weird vines grabbing you from the desert. Ugh. Ugh. So terrifying. But the healer says, it's been too long. He's not going to make it. And this is like, what? Okay, so when the script was written, Dorothy Fontana gave it to Roddenberry, and they gave it to the censors, and the censors were like, no way. This animal cannot die. This is Saturday morning cartoons. This is Bugs Bunny. No one ever put down Bugs Bunny, okay? But in this script, because there's been a change in the timeline, Ichaya is now mortally wounded, and he's dying, and he's suffering. And there's nothing they can do. And so the healer says, he has to be put down. The logical thing to do, the compassionate thing to do, is to put him down. And that's when young Spock becomes a Vulcan, because he realizes the logic of it. He wants to stay with this animal as long as he can. The human side wants to stay with him. But the Vulcan side says, no. No, I have to put this creature out of its suffering. And so he takes the euthanasia hypo, and he euthanizes his pet. Wow. I can tell you, as a kid, this disturbed me, this upset me, but I never forgot it. And in some ways, I understood. In some ways, as a child, you want to see these things because you try to understand the mysteries of death, especially the death of a pet. Because we all go through that at some point in time. If you have a pet, something's going to happen and one of your pets going to die, even if you're going to step on it, as Darth Vader. The censor said, absolutely no way. There's no way we are going to allow a pet to be euthanized on Saturday morning cartoons. Fortunately, Gene Roddenberry had total creative control over the show, and he's like, I don't give a shit. This is going to happen. Again, his complicated past of Gene Roddenberry, he loved fighting authority, and he stuck up for DC Fontana. She didn't even know this occurred. She didn't know this was going on, that there was a debate about this. She just wrote the script, like, well, there you go. But he fought for that, and he fought for her. And we got this amazing, just heartbreaking scene where he puts down his own animal. And for some reason, this is a change in the timeline. For some reason, because he didn't go through the portal, or because he went through the Garden of Forever, there was a price to be paid, basically, that he had to lose his animal. Because if we recall in Journey to Babel, like, there's no, he's like, oh, it's, you know, it's my teddy bear. No, there's no emotion connected to this. But now when he comes through, he has to make this sacrifice. And I'm trying to find, what is the line? I'll have to find this. I'm going to stop this right now, because this is an important line here. Okay, I'm back. I found it. So Spock comes through, and, you know, Thalen must be gone. He said he beamed him back up, but really he beamed him to oblivion. And he said, did it work? He says, yes, it worked. I saved myself. And then Kirk says, did anything happen? And he said, one small thing was changed this time, the death of a pet. And, you know, Kirk's like, a pet? Well, that wouldn't, let's see, he says, a pet died. A pet. Well, that wouldn't mean much in the course of time. And then Spock says, it might to some. This is a wonderful bookended beat to The City on the Edge of Forever, where Kirk says, let's get the hell out of here. Where Spock's, think about this. Think about what has just happened here. And if this show is truly going to be accepted as canon, that in fact, Ichaya, Spock's pet, died because of him. Because he had to go back and save himself. That was the sacrifice. As a result of that, he became a Vulcan. He followed the Vulcan disciplines for years and years and years until he met Kirk and then started to open up his human side. And Kirk says that wouldn't have a big effect, and Spock says it might to some. This is basically, I mean, and since time is this kind of fluid thing, but this is what made Spock who he was. And we're changing history from this point on, aren't we? In the original series, his pet was still alive. But now it's all been retroactively continuity'd to the point now where he is at in a loss for this pet. Spock had said goodbye to Sarek and said, hey, you know, be cool with your son. Just be cool with your son. You know, I saved your son. Be cool with him in the future. And Sarek says, okay, a weird request, but I'll honor it. And then we come back to the ship after this little exchange, and Spock tells a little bit of a joke. And Bones says, oh, you don't tell jokes. And Spock says, well, times change. It's supposed to be kind of like a lighthearted beat. But really, times did change. And as a result of this, did Spock become a little more lighthearted? I mean, this is the last time we're going to see him until he goes back and tries to become full-on Vulcan. So something changed with this. Does he try to go back and say, I need to get rid of this pain from the death of this animal? I don't know. I will tell you that the last pet that I lost that was significant to me was when my cat Kitty died. My sister wanted to name it Butterscotch. But I wanted to be a little more on the nose. I was never going to have a cat named Butterscotch. It was my sister's cat, so we named it Kitty. And that cat lived for a long time. And it was a great cat. It lived for 20 years. And he was like my best friend for a long time. He always hung out. He was such a nice, gentle cat. Go out and hang out in the woods with me, you know. Go catch snakes, go catch mice, you know. We both would. No, that's not true. And then I went off to California, met my wife, got into film and television and theater. And then one day my dad called, or actually I left an email and said that Kitty had died. And he was buried in our backyard, and there's a little headstone he had created that says Kitty on it. And when that happened, when I found out about that, I wept. I wept in my fiancé's arms for a good 5 or 10 minutes. Because for 20 years, that cat had been so close to me, and now he was gone. And everything that he had given to me, I was both mourning and celebrating. And here's Spock. And he has to sacrifice his best friend.